Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The economic crisis, says Reverend Jim Wallace, is also a moral and spiritual crisis. After decades of putting the market on a pedestal, says this evangelical progressive, we're left with a market meltdown and a big hole where our values used to be. In his new book, Rediscovering Values, Wallace says it's time to stop asking when the recession will end and start asking what comes next at the deep level of values. This hour, On Point, Reverend Jim Wallace and America's moral recovery. Joining me now from New York is Jim Wallace. He's an evangelical Christian minister, author, and activist, founder of the social justice organization Sojourners, and editor of Sojourners magazine. His new book is Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street. Jim Wallace, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's nice to be back.
It's good to have you, but in the midst of tough times, we see the savings lost and the jobs lost and the unemployment. We see that crisis. What's the spiritual crisis you're talking about, Jim?
Well, Tom, I wrote the book because I think that America is ready for a national conversation about values. As you said before, beneath this economic crisis, there really is a values crisis as well. And so as we read today in the paper about economic recovery, we really won't get there without a moral recovery. And as you suggested, it's about asking the right questions. The politicians all want to tell us when will the crisis end. I say in the book, the real question, the better question is how will the crisis change us? And that's why I wrote this book, to try to help jumpstart that kind of national conversation which we so desperately need, because we're in deep trouble as a society.
I think a lot of people right now would be happy for a job and a paycheck and a little stability. So what's wrong with that? Are you saying that's not the thing to long for? That's not enough?
Oh, no. We need jobs for sure, and this recovery has been aimed, you know, much more at Wall Street than Main Street. I was in Detroit to start this tour, my hometown, where unemployment's, 30% is actually a lot higher than that. And we had a terrific kind of town meeting in Detroit on a cold Monday afternoon, and jobs there are very primary. And the book talks about work and jobs and how this recovery really is not really aimed at, you know, ordinary Americans, a quarter of whom now have mortgages that that cost more or worth more than their house.
So what's the deeper conversation you want to have? Define this spiritual crisis for us.
Right. Well, I think it's on a number of levels. In the end of the book, there are these 20 moral exercises, and it ranges from the personal, family, community, congregational, to national issues and political issues, where we put our money and all the rest. So, you know, I talk about the new maxims, Tom, that have overtaken us, like greed is good, it's all about me, and I want it now. And those kind of values really wreck economies and cultures, families, and I think even our souls. And to counter that, we need some old virtues that come from the heart of our religious and moral traditions, like enough is enough. We're in this together. And I love the Native American notion that you evaluate decisions today by their impact on the seventh generation out. So I think a conversation about values really is now in the hearts and minds of a lot of people. And I saw just in Detroit 2 days ago how that really can happen now.
So this re-evaluation you're calling for, is it is this a you're a Christian minister? Is this a Christian re-evaluation you're calling for? Is it a secular political reevaluation? Is this a conversation open to all Americans, or is it for your congregation?
No, religion has no monopoly on morality or values, and so people in Detroit were across the spectrum, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, or no faith at all. But the values conversation is one we can all engage in. I do think that our own traditions have correctives. Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount tells us not to worry. Don't be anxious, he said, for what you eat, drink, and put on. And advertising says worry all the time. the prophets talk about leaving the edges of the fields for the gleaning for the poor and welcoming those in need to the table. Islam doesn't allow usury, so the banks that did Sharia banking are doing a lot better. The book talks about good examples of how we can do this right. I talk about a banker in New Jersey who didn't bundle his mortgages, these securities, and didn't do what his colleagues did. And he was told he's going to lose a lot of money. He said, well, I've got plenty of money. I value my customers. So he wouldn't do it. And now his bank was on the cover of Fortune magazine as the banker of the year. And he won, I think he won this award called the first annual George Bailey Award from the It's a Wonderful Life movie,
right,
which is a movie about banking. Mm-hmm. So Ron Hermanis is his name, and he says, Jim, I love to be called George now. So I talk in the book about stories of how you can do this right and how we've done it wrong. And so, relationships matter, I say in the book. People used to know their bankers. Bankers knew them. They knew where their mortgages were. Social sins matter. Gandhi talked about two of his deadly social sins were wealth without work and commerce without morality. Those are diagnostic now of where we are. And I think the common good really is our own good. Finally, keeping up with the Joneses needs to be replaced by making sure the Joneses are okay. And I'm talking about a lot of things happening in congregations around the country, in communities where people are really talking about new models of mutual aid and dealing with hunger. I mean, 6 million Americans now, their only income is food stamps. So congregations forming credit unions and dealing with housing and jobs. A congregation in Ohio, Columbus, the pastor called me one day and said, I want to take an offering. It's a big church, but a lot of unemployed people. An offering for the unemployed in my congregation in Columbus. And on a Palm Sunday, they raised $600,000. And they're now creating this whole center for finding people jobs. In Detroit, as this week, the Capuchin Fathers are giving out hundreds of thousands of plants, and it's seeding this community garden movement in Detroit. Hundreds of gardens on squatted land, abandoned lots, and it's good food, it's employment, and it's a community building thing. So I think the green shoots of hope are beginning, even in places like Michigan and Ohio, where sometimes all you have left is hope.
I know you've had a different vision for a long time, Jim, and I want to look at more of your prescription here, but I want to test your thesis a little more. I mean, who's to say it's a moral crisis and not simply a very deep economic crisis that we're in right now? I know that's your predilection. That's the sort of camp you come from. But what's your evidence that it's a moral crisis and not simply a deep economic one?
Well, it's both. And I talk about economists like Adam Smith, who, of course, wrote The Wealth of Nations and coined the phrase the invisible hand of the market. And I was speaking at Davos last year at the World Economic Forum to all these CEOs. And I said, what happens when and they had a panel at Davos. This is not a religious gathering. They had a panel on values and the market. This was their topic. And I said, what happens when the invisible hand lets go of the common good, lets go of some basic values? Adam Smith, in his previous book, The Moral Sentiment, said, without a moral framework, without any ethical notions of what's right and wrong, the market can't be successful. And Schumpeter, who's an Asian, who's an Austrian economist from the 40s, Joseph Schumpeter, he said the same thing. He said, without any kind of moral sensibility, the market ends up devouring other sectors and finally devours itself. So these two are not Marxist economists or religious people. They're saying you have to have some kind of moral framework. So Michael Sandel at Harvard, I quote him in the book, how the market triumphalism or market fundamentalism has gone beyond any limits. Harvey Cox, the Harvard theologian, talks about the market now as God almost, where the market is all-knowing, all-powerful, omnipresent, omniscient, all those sort of things. And so I think we have to talk about the limits of the market and the moral framework necessary for the market to succeed. And, you know, I was in a very moving it was a press conference before Christmas in, on the steps of the U.S. Treasury building, Washington, D.C. It was with homeowners that are being foreclosed. These were all first-time buyers of condos and houses. And a number of them had enough money to get a fixed rate mortgage, but they got tricked into these exotic adjustable mortgage rates, and now they're their mortgages were time bombs. And this woman named Mercy Martinez, she spoke before I was to give a religious perspective, and she started to cry. And it just made me angry. I was looking at the Bank of America building and the White House across the street, and the president was meeting with the bankers. And a number of us as clergy noted that because of our feared economic meltdown, we extended a lot of grace, you might say, to these big banks, bailouts, taxpayer money. And now this drama of banks and bailouts and now bonuses has become what I write about in the book as a bad morality play. And so now the grace we extended is not being extended to these homeowners. And then I learned that the bonuses and post-compensation, post-salary compensation to the executives of Bank of America, these top banks could pay could adjust all these mortgages, could prevent this foreclosure crisis. And it's not. They've adjusted 100 loans, Bank of America. That's why Joy and I, my wife and I, have taken our little account out of Bank of America. And that's sparking a mini movement now, people moving their money. These are moral issues.
Wallace joins us today from New York City. We've got a lot of callers. Stacia, Beverly Farms, Massachusetts. Stacia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have something to add. I just want to say that I'm a 20-something, and I totally agree that there's some kind of movement going on, and not necessarily religious like this gentleman says, but it's more like an idea of humanism in business, something that we're all going to have to adopt, either through working or buying local, something that we need to reconnect with our community to rebuild our sense of family in the community and our pride in work, changing from a consumer society to relying on each other in kind of smaller ways. And I think that that has a lot to do with, like, just ethics and morals and business. I think a lot of people who are a lot of business owners are going to have to like invest in smaller ways and in smaller enterprises and renewable things that that are going to go a lot longer way in the economy.
Do you see it coming? Do you see it happening? Is this a view that I don't know your neighbors, your friends share, or do you feel out on a limb with it?
No, I definitely see it, and I think I see a lot of people deferring to smaller local businesses, even if it's going to be more expensive or a little bit less. If it's just a little bit further away, or you know, it's just like it may be a little bit harder for them to bear, but you know, it's your neighbors and everybody needs to pull together, and I see a change, definitely.
Stacia, we hear it. You're willing to put values higher on the priority scale. Jim Wallace, I can imagine there are plenty of economists listening here and shaking their head and saying, you know, that's just not the way it works. I mean, it's nice. It may be teachings in the Bible or elsewhere, but the economy is about, efficiencies and scale and growth, sir, and we all know that.
Well, Stacia's right, and Stacia's a sign of what's happening in the country. I mentioned the bankers, the Bank of America and all the rest. This is a parable of the unmerciful bankers, basically. And they're not fulfilling their obligations, their moral obligations. They were bailed out, and now they're giving bonuses to their executives, and they're not trying to help the people who need some adjustment on their loans. Bank of America has adjusted 100 loans. That's it. So there is a movement that Stacia's referring to growing around the country. There's even a website called moveyourmoney.com where people are moving their money from the big banks that have behaved so shamelessly, and I would say bad economically. Banks that have behaved better, have trusted their relationships with their customers, have honored those, are doing better. These are not just moral decisions that have no economic consequences. We need an economic recovery. That's exactly right. But we've lost our way in terms of values. So the CEOs at Davos time were very keen to have this conversation, not just as sort of a ethical sidebar, but somehow the loss of values is an essential reason why we have spun out of control economically. And Stacia's right. People have a sense of going back to some basic virtues, doing business in a different way. I hope and pray we're ready for this, because if we're not, if we go back to business as usual, if we go back to what was the old normal, we'll just repeat the cycle all over again, not learn anything, and we'll be back in the same mess. And I think this crisis, the pain, the suffering that's been so deep in places like my hometown of Detroit, mm-hmm. this could be redeemed if we learn something. If we don't learn anything, then all that pain and suffering will just be in vain, and I just don't want to see that.
Redemption through a crisis. Beth in Charleston, South Carolina. Beth, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Great topic. My thought is that so often we hear the market or the economy addressed as if it's an entity to itself. You know, we forget that it's human beings that go into their mm-hmm. offices each day with their own moral or ethical feelings about things, and mm-hmm. they're individuals. And so I think we need this conversation very much, that we need to realize, you know, that the individuals that make their decisions face to face with their clients, that's where it needs to begin as well.
Beth, we hear it. Jim Wallace?
Well, I think Beth's talking about the recovery on Main Street, and we've been so focused on Wall Street that we've lost sight of what Beth is saying. Ordinary people make decisions every day. Small businesses, small business owners, all of us, our money's part of our life, our identity, and so what we do with it is crucial. And at the end of the book, I talk about even very personal things like Stacia and Beth were both talking about, like write down your life priorities. What's really important to you with your spouse, your closest relationships? Then look at your calendar and look at your budget. Calendars and budgets are moral documents. They reflect what's important, who's important, where we spend our time, and look at how your priorities line up with your calendar and your budget. And so I think this kind of audit, it's kind of a lifestyle audit, a values audit, I think that's going on now. And I think one of the powerful things that could come out of this is Main Street really asking these questions fundamentally, and the casino gamblers of the Wall Street economy being kind of left aside. You know, they say they're too big to fail, the big banks. I say let's make them smaller. If churches and ordinary people and congregations and denominations and individuals, religious or not, begin to move their money, that'll get Wall Street's attention pretty quickly.
Are you making this argument as a Christian minister? Are you making a Christian argument against something? Are you making a Christian argument against capitalism?
No. In the book, it talks, as I said, Adam Smith and Joseph Schumpeter are capitalist economists, and they're saying, Michael Sandel was saying the same thing, they're saying that values and moral frameworks and ethics are important. This is not, Tom, a religious issue per se. I think our religious traditions have things to contribute to this. I did a piece for the Washington Post last Sunday on how, if we remember old virtues and values, some religious and some not, we'll be better off now. But this is not a a religious question. It's not about churches and synagogues only. It's about all of us and about our values. So if we do what Beth and Stacia are talking mm-hmm. about, we'll all be in good shape here.
But Jim, I'm looking here at comments quoted in the American Spectator from your CEO of Sojourners, Chuck Gutensohn. They quote him saying, there's a fundamental and irremediable tension between capitalism and Christian faith. Is that your view?
Well, there is in economy, there's got to be some moral framework. No, I don't think the market by itself is wrong that somehow socialism is – I was asked by a radio host yesterday, am I a communist? And the answer is no. But I want to talk about regaining some of our values and ethics here. And so I do think – when we say greed is good, I think that's bad for people's souls. It's also bad for the economy, because if we have no sense of looking out for each other, no sense of what I call multiple stakeholders, that is not just the quarterly profit and loss statement or the shareholders, it's workers, it's consumers, it's the environment, it's even future generations. So how do we get a multiple stakeholder ethic going here in terms of evaluating the market by, it's not just what's right, but what works. And there's often a correlation between what's right and what works, and we've lost that here.
Jim Wallace's new book is Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street. He joins us from New York. Jim, stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation from Stanford, California, Todd Lindbergh, political scientist. He's a research fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, contributing editor at the conservative Weekly Standard. Maybe a more conservative view of the world here. He's author of several books, including The Political Teachings of Jesus. Todd Lindbergh, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be with you. Hi,
so I think you've been listening a bit. What do you make of Jim Wallace's critique of how we, landed where we are economically? And his portrayal of the country right now isn't as much a spiritual crisis as an economic crisis.
Well, I think Jim has done a great job in opening up a very important conversation. When the going is good, people have a tendency to think that the market is a natural, self-sustaining force that works all on its own and does a good job efficiently allocating goods and services. And they tend to think that, that a free society is pretty much a natural, self-sustaining kind of thing. And in both cases, as Jim has said, this is wrong. There are prerequisites. There are things that you need, and among these is a sound moral foundation. And capitalism, I think, has done a wonderful job in terms of its ability to increase the prosperity of people in terms of relieving misery around the world. There are a couple hundred million people in China today who are not miserably poor because of markets and market systems that even the Chinese Communist government realizes are useful. Capitalism also can create wealth, which can be put to other good uses. I mean, think of the Gates Foundation and a tremendous amount of good that's doing. But again, it's exactly right. It's not natural, and we should pay attention to the things that underlie it.
But Todd, let me quote you. Here's Jim Wallace from the Washington Post, a piece he had there recently. And so he said, wrote, "The market's first commandment, there is never enough, must be replaced by the dictums of God's economy, namely, there is enough if we share it."
Well, I think more is better because so many people have so little, and it is easier to create an environment in which people are sharing when the pie is expanding. Does that mean that an unbridled pursuit of or glorification of market triumphalism is justified? Well, no, I don't think so. And I think that if that's really that was really what was going on in a lot of these in our economy or in our society more broadly, I would be worried about that too. But I do think that there is actually a lot. And Jim gets at this too. The impulse is there, but there are frankly some people who have a different perspective and who are willing to make decisions that put other people at risk, and sometimes they are relieved from having to pay the consequences of their actions, in the form of, for example, bailouts. And you know that creates the old problem of moral hazard. If you're relieved from paying the consequences of the risks that you take by somebody else having to pay them, then your behavior becomes even more risky. It's the incentive is there for you to reap the advantage that comes from risk if it pays off, but to socialize the consequences of a failure to pay off.
Jim Wallace, Todd Lindbergh says more is better because so many people have so little. I don't know, hundreds of millions of Chinese pulled out of poverty. Bill Gates with his billions, wealthy, yes, but able to help people because of that. Is this your perspective on the economic values world?
Well, I talked to Bill Gates just a month ago. Here's a guy that's given away half of his wealth. He's basically changed his vocation from business to philanthropy. He and Bill and Melinda Gates, they spoke in D.C. last month. They're on a mission. Clearly, that's how it feels about global health. Todd really is showing this is not a left-right issue. It's not a Republican-Democrat issue. It's not a religious, non-religious issue. This is a values question that I think a lot of us can really begin to have a conversation about. Ed Davos, again, I spoke to all these CEOs. It wasn't a religious crowd. It was not a left-wing crowd. Believe me, Tom. And I said, we have, just like Todd said, we thought we didn't have to bring virtue to bear on our decisions because the invisible hand would make things come out all right. But that hasn't happened. Elizabeth Warren, an economist who was advising the Congress all this, here's how she described the bailout. It's like the Wall Street institutions, they go to Las Vegas and they put their money on red 21. And if they win, great. If not, the taxpayers bail them out. Todd's right. When there's no risk involved here, bad decisions are made. It was risky behavior, like a game, a casino, a gambling parlor, on behalf of the Wall Street bankers and institutions, and a lot of Main Street people suffered. So the common good, these CEOs of Wall Street, for 3 days we had in Davos a conversation, and I listened to these CEOs, all very smart, successful business people, saying, Jim, you're right. We have forgotten some basic values. I'm not a religious person, but I've learned these values from the books my mom read to me when I was growing up, the values I embrace from my church, even though I'm not attending anymore. We've lost something here. I had an interview with McKinsey last week about this.
The consulting group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't think this is a religious issue or a political issue. I think the possibility here of a new conversation across political boundaries, across religious lines, could really help us regain our bearings. I want to regain our... The subtitle of the book is a moral compass for a new economy. We need a new economy, and there will have to be some moral compass for it. That's what the book is trying to do. It doesn't answer all the questions. I'm not an economist, Tom, but I think these questions are the right questions for us to ask. And I think a lot of people like Tom and Beth and Stacia are all asking the right questions.
Todd, do you see a conservative openness to this kind of questioning right now? Jim writes, there's enough if we share it. That hardly sounds like conservative economics.
Well, I'm not sure that I agree with that. I think that there is a kind of narrow segment of opinion that sort of is very much look out for number one and all the rest of it. But I think if you look at some of the issues that some people on the conservative side have been pushing for through the years, I mean, it's about making use of the market to bring more choices to people and to deliver better outcomes. It's not a market for the market's sake kind of argument. I think that protecting the conditions under which the capital markets work and flourish is a very important business of government. But the end of it, in addition to increasing your personal prosperity, I think also has something to do with the ability to lift other people up, and I think that's very much a part of the conservative tradition. It's certainly a an important part of the Jesus message, and a message that I think is sort of encompassing. It's anachronistic to try to go back and say, what would Jesus think the proper rate of taxation for capital gains should be? That doesn't get you anywhere. But I think you can see in what Jesus had to say about how people should get along in the world, a sort of fundamental awareness that we have responsibilities not just toward ourselves, but toward others.
Well, we'll see if and when Jim Wallace's agenda hits the floor of Congress. Todd Lindbergh at the Hoover Institution and the Weekly Standard, author of The Political Teachings of Jesus. Thank you for joining us, Todd.
Thank you.
Carl's calling from St. John's, Michigan. Carl, you're on the air with Jim Wallace.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I think while I would disagree with where we get our moral fiber from and our moral set from, whether it's religious or secular or otherwise, I would like to applaud your guest's opinion about how we need to rethink the way we look at it. I would say, though, that your other guest you had on for the professor said that there was a narrow segment of people who look out for number one, and I would disagree with that. I think that, wrong or right, America was founded on people who wanted to be landowners, and they wanted to take care of themselves and get rich, and no matter what happens to the other person. And if that wasn't the case, we wouldn't be in this situation. I mean, there's countless examples of this. Take a look at the health care issue. We're not trying to really get universal health care for people. We're trying to get universal health insurance for people, which is all about keeping business in business. So while I applaud your guest, the virtues and the where he's coming from, I think that it runs soundly in contradiction with what is the American ideal of take care of number one and take care of yourself first, take care of your own backyard.
Carl, I hear you loud and clear, and for years we've been told, you know, everybody looks out for number one, and you end up with the greatest good economically overall. Jim Wallace, there's clearly more than one tradition in this country, but there's some pretty strong tension right there.
Well, Tom, I think you're right. There is a tension there, but I think self-interest is a little different than narcissism, and I think we've plunged away from just self-interest to kind of narcissism. That's what I mean by it's all about me and I want it now. There's some funny stuff in the book, too. I know these are serious subjects, but one of my favorites was a late-night comedian I quote in the book who talked about he was on an airplane, I guess a true story, and the flight attendant said, we have wireless internet now up in the air. And they all clapped, but it's broken today. And the guy next to me says, this is bull, this is bull, this is bull. He was mad about something, not having something he didn't know existed 10 seconds ago. Mm. And I think so we have kind of transgressed some boundaries here. But I think there is a tradition in this country of looking out for each other, too. The common good means something. It's in our secular democratic history. It's in Judaism, Christianity, Islam. And the notion that we're better off if we don't just compete with the Joneses but look out for them as well. I mean, I got a 6-year-old and an 11-year-old. I'm a Little League baseball coach for both their teams. And there's an ethic around Little League baseball that really is part of the American tradition as well. And we are looking out for each other. It's all voluntary. We take care of each other's kids. We all pay to make it work. And you know, we're not just trying to get rich. We're trying to create something in the commons. I have a whole section of the book called The Commons. You know, Boston, Tom, as you know well, the Boston Commons. I think you can still legally graze cows on the commons if you want to.
I haven't seen anybody try it in a long time.
You should try it, Tom. I hear that's still. I checked and it's still possible. But this notion of when we have commons in our lives, we're all better off. When we lose the commons and just everything becomes privatized and it's just we're in it for ourselves, I don't think that's the kind of society I want my kids to grow up in. So self-interest is necessary for the market to function. But looking out for each other, I think, is a necessary corrective to all that, too. Both are traditions in American culture, and we went so far one way, we have to now bring it back with some corrective and remember the common good again.
How does this become reality, or does it, Jim? Mm-hmm. I mean, you've been a progressive, a left liberal for a long, long time. You know that there are a lot of people and powerful economic forces who are just not going to go for this, you know, share first and grow later view of the world, as much as it may be needed. I mean, is this a matter of financial regulation? Is it a matter of individual choices? Is it a matter of legislation? How does this happen?
Well, I think that it's all of the above, and that's a conversation we have to have. I don't think on this issue it's a matter of going left or going right, but going deeper. What are the, you know, Todd and I might not agree on some political issues, but on this kind of subject, I think we're going to find a lot in common. And your listeners out there across the board politically, but I think, you know, this is a conversation that a lot of people from across spectrums want to have. Yes, we need new and better financial regulations. Ben Bernanke said just this week that the lack of oversight, accountability, and regulation was a part of why we had this crisis, and he's chair of the Fed. So we do need that. But it's a structural crisis. It is, Tom. It's also a spiritual crisis. It's not one or the other. It's both at the same time. So how do we have better financial regulations? But how do we maybe challenge those banks? I mean, they've spent $300 million. 1 year after they brought us to this place, they've spent that much money to keep themselves from being regulated. They're fighting every single financial regulation on Wall Street. They haven't learned a thing up there. Main Street's learning. Wall Street appears not to be. So the people who caused this are learning the least. Those who did little to cause it but are now suffering the most are the ones doing the learning here. That's the moral contradiction. But I think we need regulation, but also need real looking in the mirror. I mean, my Depression-era parents did not spend money they didn't have for things they didn't need. And we all, I think, have to plead guilty to some of it. Even my poorest neighbors sometimes have fallen into that. So how do you look in the mirror? How do you regain your own moral compass? I read a piece in the New York Times recently. People are doing more and buying less, meaning more time with families and kids and parenting and friends. This is a good thing. So how do we regain our balance here, both in Washington, New York, and most of all on our own streets across the country?
Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee. August, you're on the air with Jim Wallace.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes,
I'd
hi.
Like to share what I believe is a perfect illustration of the lack of a moral compass. It's resulting in poor business decisions that negatively impact not only the customer, but long-term the businesses as well. Just this past week, I had two small overdrafts totaling $15, and the overdraft fees were $33 per transaction, totaling $66. And the branch manager thought, told me that he couldn't reverse those or reduce them because of the policies of the bank. And obviously, I'm going to leave that bank, so it's negatively impacted both of us. And I'd also like to ask Mr. Wallace if he sees kind of a leader in the turnaround, kind of a change of heart. I think the analogy I used was who makes the better evangelist, a preacher's son or a drug addict? Do we see one of the large banks suddenly having a change of heart in an attempt to attract all of this business that is embodied by people such as myself?
August, we'll ask that, but let me ask you first, did that banker know you? Did they know anything about you as a human being or only as a, you know, a guy with two small overdrafts?
No, actually, they do know me as a human being. They've seen me come in with my 9-year-old daughter, and they know that I'm living on unemployment after losing my job of 21 years, and that I, you know, they know it's an issue for me.
An unemployed father losing a job of 21 years with a $15 in overdrafts and a $66 charge. that doesn't sound like a parable you're going to find in Scripture, Jim Wallace, at least not in a positive light.
Well, you know, this is the answer, Tom, to the question you asked before. What are the moral issues here? I mean, August is just you know, that just screams at me. Here's somebody that the bankers know, and he's unemployed. And this is why there's an effort to put in a consumer financial protection agency in these new financial regulations to prevent this kind of abuse. This is abusive. And we could start talking about credit cards and what they've done to so many people. This is abusive financial behavior. It's bad economics long term. It's short-term gain and long-term misery and long-term disaster. But it's also a moral issue. And so I think August is right to say, I mean, I want to see where the drug addicts or the risk addicts or the Wall Street gambler addicts. I want to see some leadership from them, too. I'd like to know where it's going to come. Let me make
He's saying who's leading in banking and business.
Let's make a concrete suggestion. I want to say, I want to ask the Citibank, Bank of America, and Chase and Wells Fargo, I want to ask these banks that they forego these executives forego their bonuses for this next year, forego their post-salary compensation, and use that money instead to adjust the mortgages, modify the mortgages, and keep their those whom they lend it to, like August, keep them in their homes. They should forego their bonuses and their post-salary compensation for this year in order to keep those people in their homes. Now, that would be leading. That would be showing some leadership, moral leadership, and it would help us because it's bad when houses foreclose in your own neighborhood. Your own neighborhood goes down when houses get boarded up. So let's ask them to provide that kind of leadership. And I think then we might be making some positive direction here.
Do you think any of the CEOs you were dining out with in Davos, Switzerland, are going to do that, Jim?
Well, you know, last year we had this, as I said, this panel. I was on the panel with the former Prime Minister of the UK, and Tony Blair said, Jim, they must be in crisis if they're having a panel on values in the market and asking you to speak to it. This year, Tony Blair and I are going to do another panel, a plenary panel, and the question is, how has this changed us? How have we now behaved differently? So I'm going to take your question, Tom, to that gathering at the end of January and ask, how have we changed here? I do think that August said he's taken his money out of that bank. Joy and I have taken our money out of Bank of America. I do think when ordinary citizens on Main Street and maybe some congregations and the Methodists have a $15 billion pension fund. Now, if they decided to take, I'm not sure where it even is, but if that's in a big bank, it probably is, and they decided to take that out of that bank and put it in local banks, that would get the attention of Wall Street, trust me.
You know, you say it's not left, right, but it's deeper. But what about, there's been a whole great movement for years and years now within the Christian community, the prosperity gospel. I'm sure you know it well. Does that line up with what you're talking about here, or does that have to go on the scrap heap to pay attention to the Jim Wallis view today?
Let me be clear about this. The prosperity gospel is a biblical heresy. plain and simple, it's just contrary to what the Bible teaches, and it's the kind of it says, as your listeners probably know, that if you are wealthy, it's probably a sign of favor from God, and if you're not, if you're poor, it's probably a sign that you've done something wrong. The Bible says the opposite. The Bible questions. It's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom than the camel to go through the eye of a needle. I mean, the Bible is at least challenging and suspicious of great wealth in the midst of poverty. And continually, as a young seminarian, all the verses in the Bible about the poor, we found them all, then cut them all out of the Bible. And there were 2,000 verses we had to cut out of the Bible about the poor and God's care for the oppressed and the widow and the orphan and all the rest. There's a new Bible that World Vision has put out called the Poverty and Justice Bible, where all those verses are put back in and underlined in World Vision orange. So it's trying to put it all back together again. But I think the prosperity gospel should be thrown on the scrap heap, the dust heap of history. It should be just put aside. It was wrong. In fact, there's an article, I think, in Atlantic or Harper's this month, how the prosperity gospel even helped lead to this crisis with pastors telling some of their parishioners to go ahead and take out bad loans and you can't afford it, but God wants you to be wealthy. And there's even some indication from the article of collusion between some pastors, some of these prosperity preachers, and some local bankers who come to the congregation and help people set up bad loans. Now, if that's the case, there's more than bad theology here. It's unethical behavior.
Let's get a call from Burlington, Vermont. And Robert. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jim. Jim, I met you long ago at Reba Place. I want to talk about this efficiency, scale, and growth thing, Tom, that you said. Isn't that all about efficiency, scale, and growth? Adam Smith's book happened on a planet that was less than 1 billion people, I think. We should be thinking about sustainability. Since then, we've been overfishing oceans. Our CO2 has gone over the line that global warming appears to be irreversible. It's not about growth. We cannot grow ourselves out of this. And the thing with China, notwithstanding, that Todd Lindbergh pointed out, even China will hit a wall in terms of growth because of the consumption of resources, and it is so short-sighted for policymakers and for people to just think that we can grow ourselves out of this in this finite planet.
Well, Robert, it's strongly put, and we've only got a couple of minutes here. Let me put it to Jim. Sustainability, a piece of your vision, Jim?
Oh, there's a whole section here called New Habits of the Heart, and the first chapter is the Clean Energy Economy Conversion. Robert's exactly right. We haven't had time to get into this here, but the ethic, the movement from growth to sustainability is not only an important economic move, but it's also part of the moral recovery that we need. And you know, when 70% of our economy is based on consumption and not rebuilding infrastructure and changing our entire energy grid, to change the energy grid, we need to be rewired ourselves, not just the grid, but ourselves. So there's jobs there, there's growth in the places where there isn't growth now, but overall we're moving toward a sustainability ethic and not just an endless growth ethic. Tom is right. Robert's right on to something here. And I think there's a whole section in the book about how practically this could reorient our whole economic life in ways that are more consistent with our values and the limits of a planet that we are overtaxing every single day. So there's a lot of possible change in direction here that I think is very hopeful. So I'm actually very hopeful about how this crisis can be redeemed again if we use it to change our direction. If we don't, we'll be in more trouble than ever. But if we do, I think there's a real possibility of some change down the road. It's a conversation all of us can get into, and I wrote the book just to help start the conversation.
Well, we hear the outline of it loud and clear today. A lot of history makes one wonder if even an economic crisis this large will really turn the ship. But maybe. Are you optimistic about this kind of change, Jim? You think it's coming?
I feel the country's ready for it. Your callers today indicate that. Again, I hear it all over the country. I think it's a conversation begging to happen. The news cycle doesn't do it. The politicians won't do it. The media is not doing it. But on Main Street, on our streets, the conversation wants to happen. I think it could. I think it will. I'm hoping and praying that it does for our sake.
The book is Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, A Moral Compass for the New Economy. Jim Wallace, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.